designer satisfaction has a lot to do with intentionality. The ultimate design quest as a designer is to design ourselves.
That's Kate Pincott. Kate is a design coach, CEO, and founder of Remote Design Coaching. She's on a mission to help designers get unblocked in their careers so that they can find their own design voice. She brings in her own vast experience as a product designer, working for brands such as Facebook, Ustu, and Barclays. I invited Kate on my show because I think her work really embodies what I'm trying to convey through this podcast, which is helping designers know themselves better so that they can make an impact that aligns with who they really are. In this episode, Kate and I talk about how designers can conduct lean experiments on their own lives and careers to continuously learn and grow. Kate also shares her own story of success, burnout, and reflection, and how important it is to trust your own gut. Stick around, because Kate will also reveal her findings on the top three needs for designers.
This is the Design Feeling Podcast with your host, Nirish Shakyar.
Hi, I'm Nirish Shakyar, and I'm a designer, educator, and the host of my new podcast, Design Feeling. Most of the time, you'll probably find me helping organizations put their customers first. Or you might find me teaching design thinking and creative innovation. But I'm on a slightly different quest here. To explore the human behind the designer. Who you are. What drives you. What frustrates you. And why. And ultimately, how you can bring more impact and meaning into your work. On this podcast, my expert guests and I will be uncovering ways to increase your self-awareness, creative confidence, and meaning. One of the first things that I wanted to know from you, and this is probably the classic question that every designer gets asked, how did you get into design?
I fell into design by mistake, actually. I was an art student in art college in London, and I was doing weird art installations with hair dryers hanging from the ceiling and watching motion sensors and electronics. And I wanted to trap people inside my installations and see what they would do. So I was really interested in communication, but in a very playful kind of cheeky way. And my tutor at the time said, it's not that much money in art as a career for you. And I think that you might be better going the graphic design route and kind of looking at communication. So I kind of went into wayfinding for kind of museums and physical interaction. And then slowly that, you know, led to the website boom, and everybody wanted a website, and I kind of just fell into it. So there was never any plan. I just was so curious about how people work and what motivates humans and their behavior. And that's what kept me going.
Yeah, it's always so fascinating to hear about these stories of how designers get into design. So, Kate, you had a very stellar career in design. And then from there, you transitioned into becoming a design coach. How did that transition happen for you?
Yeah, I was kind of top of my game. Felt like I was flying. On the outside, I had a top job in tech. I was traveling the world doing user research, everything paid for me, business flights. I was doing talks at conferences, speaking about things that I cared about. I was working with super talented people, and the work that I was doing was affecting billions of people. And so by all measures, you would have thought that I was super happy. You know, I'd worked really hard to get to that level. And you would have thought I sat on the top of the hill and said, woohoo, I made it. But actually, I was not aligned with myself. I was not aligned with my values. And I started to realize that I knew my users better than I knew myself. I knew all the people I was user researching and fighting for and designing for and problem solving for more than I actually knew my own values and what my pain points were. And the things that mattered to me the most. And I crashed and burnt. So I had a really big burnout. My mental health was not very good. And I ended up quitting my job. And I spent some time with my husband, Abdullah, who's a woodworker. And we spent lots of time in the trees, learning about wood and plants. And I started to use my hands and moving away from the computer for a while just to do something different. And slowly, I was able to learn what mattered to me the most. And I slowly started to realize that it was actually the people that I was most passionate about, not the pixels. And that's when I transitioned from pixels to people. And that's when I started learning about coaching. And I realized that I had managed to get myself out of a really, really tough situation into a place where I was thriving and calm and confident again. And I was thinking, I wonder if I can do this for other people. So then I started prototyping and playing with this framework that I developed. And that's how I started my coaching business.
I love it how you say people, not pixels, right? And I mean, that does remind me of what we do as designers. We do design for people, but like you said, it's so easy to just forget about the person who's actually doing the design. How did you come to that realization about yourself? Like, how did you even see yourself or make yourself aware of yourself?
Yeah. I think the biggest blocker I had to learning about myself and doing user research on myself was I wouldn't sit still for long enough. I was always busy moving, doing, going, being. And I prided myself in being busy. Oh, yes, I'm doing all these things. My calendar's so booked. As if somehow that gave me some validity or significance. And when I spent time in nature and in the trees and in the woods, you know, outside of our garden, time would just fly. And the tangible result that I would get from that time was this beautiful sense of peace and calm. And I started looking at that output or impact on my life and thought, wow, I value this way more than some, you know, page view metric or some other kind of OKR that didn't resonate with me. And so I think it was just learning to be still. And obviously, a lot of people listening will be aware of meditation and the mindfulness movement that we're seeing across the globe expanding. And then doing lots of little experiments. That was the next thing. So listening and then starting to do some experiments. What does the new Kate look like? If I'm an MVP and I was Kate 1.0, what does 2.0 look like? How does she walk? How does she talk? What does she think? What does she wear? What does she say? How does she smell? Everything about that new version. Let's kind of visualize it and imagine it and get clear on who I am.
Great. Well, tell us about this story of going from 1.0 to 2.0. Well, how did that transition happen? What were some of these experiments you were running?
Some of them, you know, when we think about experiments, we often think about hypothesis-driven design and having to write a hypothesis statement and it being quite heavy and, you know, requiring all the stakeholders on a team. But when it's just you and you're the only stakeholder, it's quite easy to define quite quickly what's the outcome that I desire. And what's one small baby step that I can try to optimize that outcome? And so it might be something for me, it was things like, well, in between my meetings, I'd like to be a little bit more present to my senses. So I would plant little essential oil bottles in different rooms. And every time I went into the room, I'd grab one and have a deep breath. And really enjoy that smell. Or it might be, I'd like to not take myself so seriously. I'd like to be more playful and more light. How about I try and end every meeting or every conversation with something really frivolous, something really silly, no matter what the consequences, let's have a go. Because as a designer, I saw myself as very serious and I have to be serious. And I was thinking, okay, how can we change that? So just like we try on different hats, you know, when we're playing the crazy eights or six hat games in user research, you can do that with yourself and you can say, what happens if I put a different hat on today? And I try different personas. So I started to document that a lot with journaling. And that's how I slowly saw what is serving me, what is working really well, and what's not, because let's drop that. And so I started doing this kind of lean loop process, but to myself, very consistently. But it felt light. it didn't feel like a 360 peer review that you get in some of the big tech companies where you're constantly being examined and stressed about your performance. It felt effortless.
You mentioned something called a lean loop. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So the lean loop kind of came from, you know, Eric Ries, the lean startup, and build, measure, learn, build, measure, learn, build, measure, learn. And this was around, you know, 2011 or 13. I can't remember the date. And this was revolutionary because, you know, Eric was saying, instead of building, you know, 10 things and seeing which one works, why don't we test an experiment? And why don't we actually just go for it and make it? And then we're going to measure, and then we're going to learn. And this kind of way of thinking was very different to the waterfall methodology that was around at the time. And it really helped big companies to re-evaluate how they might go about their design process and their manufacture. And I think the biggest kind of outcome was that designers started to be needed on a more regular cadence. And so it started to introduce this more frequent talking between the engineering and the managers and the stakeholders. And slowly, we started to see designers being brought into the conversation a little bit more upfront, rather than just at the end, hey, can you make this pretty? Or hey, can you make this look harmonious? Oh,
and the classic one is, you know, make it pop.
Yeah, make it pop. Oh my gosh. Yeah, you're so right.
I'm just curious to know, what stops designers from doing what you just did? The way you describe it sounds like such a natural way to think about yourself in terms of stopping and reflecting and learning more by yourself. But what stops designers from doing that right now?
Yeah, I don't know the answer. I think two things come to mind. One being that often when you have a superpower, it's very easy to use it for other people. If you think about doctors and their health, they're often notorious for being very naughty with their health, aren't they? Or smoking or something like that. Or if you think about athletes, you know, they're meant to be super fit, but you often see, you know, on holiday, completely stopping their exercise regime. So I think as problem definers and solvers who interrogate and then reimagine, sometimes we're tired when we go home, you know, and we don't want to interrogate and reimagine for ourselves. And so we kind of leave our superpower suit at work and we don't bring it home with us. I think the other thing that comes to mind is normally the rules and regulations around where we operate as designers is predominantly in a group setting with stakeholders, with leaders, who give us permission to start this process. Now, obviously, this is slightly different with the entrepreneurs out there. I salute you. I love you. You just go for it proactively. But most people have a space within which they do that design thinking, within a box, right? So I think that we tend to compartmentalize and we forget that actually we have permission to have experimental mindset in all parts of our life, not just when we're doing our quote-unquote job. So I think it's that permission.
Who is meant to give that permission? Where is that meant to come from? Or why do we even need a permission for that?
That's a great question. I think it goes back to kind of the history of tech and design. So I think, you know, the last decade has all been about how can we give designers a seat at the table? The 2010s. And we've done a brilliant job of that, right? Because we have design founders that are really successful. We've got design-led companies like Uber and Airbnb that are doing really well. We've got chief design officers all over the world. The McKinsey report came out and told us how, you know, design does have a tangible ROI. So we've had lots of ways that design has been raised and brought to the boardroom. But now that we have a seat at the table, what are we going to say? And how are we going to be heard? So I think that the next decade, the 2020s, is going to all be about, well, how are we going to be heard? How are we going to speak the language of business? And that's why historically we haven't felt like we had permission. because we were shoehorned in this little box where we're constantly having to fight for user-centered design and our way of thinking. And we're just not used to it. We're used to more of a service agency kind of interaction where people tell us what to do. And then we follow it within a very small, limited framework.
That I think that's a really eye-opening perspective in terms of looking at the history of the role of design itself in a company. And like you said, I think that is so true in terms of how it's still trying to find its feet and its identity as to what it's meant to do and how it's meant to help the company, as opposed to some of the more the older traditional roles that a company might have. When did you have your, let's say, breakthrough moment where you started to kind of realize, I guess, the problem, and then looking into the solution, not just for yourself, but things that potentially could help other designers and creatives?
I think it's when I realized that everything is an experiment and everything can be turned into an experiment. A mindset, an emotional response, a reaction, the way that I reframe things. I think I started to realize that pretty much any problem I have could be broken down into an experiment, and I could have a hypothesis or a gut feeling, and I could do a little baby step towards it without fully committing to being a totally radically new person. I found that really uplifting and empowering, and I realized that I was following the lean loop. And it just occurred to me one day, I was like, oh my goodness, I'm literally doing this to myself. And I felt like, I wonder, perhaps this could be repeatable and rigorous for others. So then I started sharing it with some design friends, and I started trying it out again, iterating, doing very small experiments with some coachees and seeing if it would work for them. And it was working. And I was so excited. I was like, yes, it's working. This is reliable. This is amazing. And then I started thinking, well, maybe this needs to scale up. Like, I need to share this with more people. Because when you go from feeling lost to having clarity, or when you go from feeling low confidence to having confidence, it changes lives. It changes your whole outlook. And that felt really powerful for me. And one of my values that's really important is stewardship, which is this idea of leaving something better than when you found it. And that could be, you know, when you go to the toilet and it's a little grubby and you make it nicer for the next person. Or it could be in a conversation that you have with someone to help them grow. And so I started asking myself, how can I use this framework to be a steward and to help unblock people in whatever it is that they're wrestling with within themselves, and to really listen to their intuition and their gut. And that's how I started to develop the process, and kind of the rest is history, in the sense that I just kept working on it and iterating on it and sharing it with friends until it kind of made some kind of sense. But I'm sure I'll continue that moving forward.
Tell us about your favorite experiment or the lean loop that you ran on yourself, and what happened?
Yeah, not all of them went well, Nirish. That's the point, right?
Really?
So the whole point is to see what works. So I wanted to try and be more concise. And when I inspire people to have a really sharp, short story, and boom, see if I could set some flames on fire, I felt that I was being rather verbose, right? I was like, how can I be more sharp and concise? So with one of my coaches, I said, okay, we're going to watch a little short video clip, and we're going to look at this character, and then we're going to take something from it. And played the video, and it was short, everyone listening. I was like, so what do we take from this? You know, I was listening to people, and they're like, yeah, we don't take no for an answer. And I'm like, brilliant, yes. And what else do we take from this video? We need to push forward and have our voices heard. I'm like, yes, brilliant. Okay, great. So I want you to all go out today and be, you know, persistent with what it is that you want to be heard. Make sure that you're heard in the room. I get a call a few hours later from another manager saying, I don't know what happened, Kate, but that was a car crash of a meeting and you need to go and sort it out because one of your designers is off the rail. And I was thinking, oh God, what have I done? And I had pumped them with bravado and bravery and passion, but maybe a little bit too much, and hadn't found a way to channel that in a diplomatic way. And this particular designer had spun off the rails and got quite angry in the meeting. And so I learned my lesson, right? Which is that, you know, when I pump someone up, like when you pump a balloon up, you have to be careful that you tie a knot in it, otherwise it will fly all over the place. So I have that balloon metaphor whenever I'm pumping up something. Mm. Yeah, I'm going to make you pumped. I'm going to get you excited. Tie a knot. Make sure that there's a clear boundary and context with the advice that I'm giving so that it doesn't fly all over the place.
But that's why it's an experiment, right?
It
could work and it could fail.
Yeah.
But what that's reminded me of is I might have unconsciously ran those experiments during my own career myself, but maybe I didn't have someone to guide me through that experiment, or maybe I didn't know how to measure it or do it safely without the risk of, for example, like pissing off your manager, which sometimes, you know, maybe you can do, but within that context with a constraint. One of the things that I'm starting to see here is the value of finding a mentor or a coach in a career of a designer, which I have to say I was really bad at. I was really, well, first of all, I was really shy asking for help. And also I had a really big ego as a designer, thinking I knew everything, right? I learned this at uni and I know what I'm doing. And hey, I'm a great public speaker, or, you know, I can act, you know, confident and be this person and whatnot. It was only kind of a bit later in my career that I started realizing, you know what? You know, I would have gotten a lot farther and faster if I had coaches and mentors helping me. How do you think designers and creatives can find mentorship and coaches during pretty much any stage of their career?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I get asked that a lot by designers, because, you know, it's not designers' fault that they think, just like the way you mentioned, I felt the same. I've got all this bravado and all this confidence. I can do everything. And it's actually not designers' fault at all. It's the system that they're in. And they are taught, don't show vulnerability, don't show your cards, don't tell me all the things that you're finding difficult, because you won't be trusted then. And there's a lot of pressure on designers to have trust in their team, because they are the glue, right? The designers are the invisible glue that holds the team together. And if they are perceived as weak or not knowing what they're doing, they feel like they're going to be judged as incompetent or not a good designer, and that will reflect badly on their performance review. So we need to change that, because that's not okay. All of us should have space to make mistakes and to ask questions and to hold doubt, because, you know, leadership is about that clarity and confidence and doubt. We need both. And so I think that, you know, the old model of leadership is this dictatorial leader that knows all the answers. And actually now we're in a new era where leadership is servanthood and is about listening and relying on the people below you. So I hear a lot of people say, well, how can I get a coach? You know, I can't talk to someone in my team because they know me. They're not a neutral thought partner. How can I can't talk to my manager because they do my performance review. I've got lots of design friends, so I could call them. You know, I've got a good network. I could talk to them, but it's kind of ad hoc. It's not very regular. I'm not getting that regular growth and progression. I can't talk to a mentor because they tell me what's gone wrong in their life, and they tell me their values and their career paths and all the things I should avoid that they did, which really have nothing to do with me. So they're kind of stuck, you know, and it's very lonely. And a lot of designers feel very lost. And when they experience coaching, they see quite different conversation, where actually I'm asking them questions and they are tapping into their internal wisdom. And I'm not telling them my internal wisdom. I'm trying to get at what matters to them the most, and I'm reflecting back. So I think the first answer to your question is to find people that, number one, are trained in coaching, because it's not a normal conversation. It's a different type of conversation, which has a very clear structure and framing. And second of all, to find someone that's coaching within your industry. So someone that's walked the path, someone that's been in your shoes, someone that really understands design, So something that I hear a lot is that designers are looking for a bespoke, tailored coaching package that acknowledges their strengths, acknowledges their personality, their values, their drivers, and is not a generic coaching journey that is could be fitting anyone.
And one of the things that I've read in terms of like the things you talk about is something called designer satisfaction. What is designer satisfaction? Because I've mostly heard of things like, you know, customer satisfaction and user satisfaction, but I haven't really come across this term called designer satisfaction. What does that mean to you?
I hadn't pulled that out as a marketing word in my mind, so I'm going to have to think about it. I think generically, what I'm optimizing for with my coachees is that they are aligned with who they are. So the work that they're doing is aligned with their values. They are aware of their drivers, their motivators, intrinsic and extrinsic, and they are intentionally going forward with that. So I think designer satisfaction has a lot to do with intentionality. If we're kind of just bumbling in the dark, kind of trying to find our way forward, and we're not really designing our career, then it will design us. And so I think it's really important. The ultimate design quest as a designer is to design ourselves. And so I think designer satisfaction comes from how much are we aware of that? How intentional are we being? Or are we just kind of going with the flow and hoping for the best and actually not seeing much alignment with who we are? And I think a lot of pain, if you look at in any of the kind of well-being self-help world, it always speaks about the importance to be aligned with who you are in all parts of your life. And when we pull away from that, that's when we suffer and we feel a lot of pain. And I think that's the same with designers. So for me, I hadn't worked out what my key values were. I was optimizing for things like ambition and recognition and prestige. Whereas actually, I don't actually care about those things. What I actually care about when you go, why, you know, doing the five whys all the way down, is connection. Connection is what gets me really elated. I love connection. Creating connections, thinking about frameworks and processes to enable connection, connection to self and connection with others. And I never would have known that if I hadn't done some serious internal work through coaching methodologies.
Wow. So are you saying that a lot of times we do things as designers without a conscious awareness of the intention behind which we do things and the why? So for example, for you, you value connection, and I'm assuming that's what makes you happy. And it might be something different for me.
That's right.
And that is a very powerful thing to be aware of for me, in terms of knowing why you do things, so that maybe you can do more of that, right? Things that bring you more joy, rather than the things that don't. How can us designers start to learn more about what should be our intentions? Or what are our intentions?
Yeah. I don't think there is one silver bullet. There's one magic question that you have to ask yourself, or one process. I've come across many, many different ways. But the baseline, the common denominator, is to ask yourself better questions. And to do that through a reflective practice. If anybody's interested in being more intentional and in learning a self-coaching methodology, or even adopting the reality prototyping methodology for themselves, it would be schedule time. Schedule a small amount of time, not a huge. We don't want to set ourselves up to fail immediately. Do a really baby step. Just schedule 10 minutes. And in that 10 minutes, ask yourself, what are my intentions for today? What are my goals for today? And once you've got that, you're just practicing thinking within yourself and being still. And then you can maybe increase it to 20 minutes and you can start to think of, well, what am I scared of? And what do I maybe need to let go of today? And then maybe you can increase it and you can ask yourself on different days, how am I feeling? What are my emotions? Let's just write them down. Let's learn to name them. So, you know, so much of what we do is about emotion. We design for emotion. And yet our vocabulary as designers is shocking. Again, no judgment. It's not our fault. But as designers, we need to get better at naming motion. So I have the feelingswheel.com opened all the time so that I've got the names of emotions that we're
Is that a website? Feelingswheel.com?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I'll check it out. So let's say today in the morning, I am running some user research or let's say some collaborative ideation workshop with my stakeholders or clients. What could I write down as an example in that 10, 15 minutes?
So our intention, as many of you will know, is our approach to things. How do we want to go about things today? And the goal is the specific task that we want to unlock or achieve. So the intention might be to go about this user testing playfully. It might be to go about it diligently. It might be to go about it with calm and confidence. Maybe you want to go about it with curiosity and awe. So when we think about what is our intention, how do we wish to go about today? Then we can look at the task that we want to achieve, which might be to get really good quality user insights or to avoid using leading questions or, biasing the interview, or to making sure that we build rapport with that interviewer before we, go into the interview or something like that. Then we carry that intention with us. And so even if we don't achieve the goal, at least we've achieved that intention. We've approached it with an attitude and we've had that calm or we've had that joy or that curiosity. And it kind of takes the sting away from the goal being achieved or not being achieved. It doesn't really matter because actually our way of being, the journey, has been more important. And I think that's a key to enjoying any career, not just design careers, but to enjoy the journey and not just the end goal and the destination, which I know is a bit of a cliche.
Kind of reminds me of a design manifesto or design principles. Are they similar or is this what you're talking about a bit different?
I think in the program Reality Prototyping, I encourage each designer to write their own principles, their own manifesto, so that they're really clear on what matters to them the most. So it is very similar. And I get the coaches to write out some affirmations and some statements, which are very similar to a manifesto because it's, this is what I am. This is, I acknowledge who I am. I am all these things. And I see myself as these things. And it's very positive and affirming and empowering. And it's a great reminder to come back to, just the way that principles help us in our software to remind us what we care about as a team.
Tell us about reality prototyping. What is reality prototyping?
Well, I'm considering, I'm thinking about the name all the time. But at the moment, reality prototyping is acknowledging that prototyping happens in every industry, in the building industry, in fashion, where they make little mock-ups. Architects make little buildings, ceramicists make little clay models. We all make prototypes. We practice and we envision what we want our future to look like. And we try and do it to save money and to avoid wastage and save time. But all those examples are so physical. And reality prototyping is the idea of things as they are, as you perceive them. Your reality is your perception of the world around you. And we often think of it as quite a physical truth. But actually, if we think Matrix style, it's really bendy. And depending on your blood sugar levels, depending on your hormones, lots of different factors in your biology, your reality is completely different, right? And we know this because you can walk into a room and say, I can't find the pen. Where's the pen? I really need to find this pen. And then your partner says, darling, it's right in front of you. And you're like, no, it's not. I can't see it.
Like, that's so me.
It's literally right in front of you. And obviously when you open yourself to a possibility that it is in front of you and you're not just angrily rushing around, the pen is there. And so we know that our reality hugely shifts depending on what mood we're in and where we're going. And that shouldn't be a negative thing. That should be an exciting thing. Wow. I'm a reality bender. I can bend my reality any way I want. How cool is that? And so I think as designers, it is a great question. How do we want to bend reality? not in a delusional way, you know, to go around pretending that you are something you're not, but in a way that empowers you to feel like you have agency over it.
So is it to do with how you perceive things? Because as I say, your perception becomes your reality, and in being aware of that perception?
Exactly. So it's just playing with self-prototyping. So I look at who I am. I look at my perceptions. I look at my self-awareness. I look at how I perceive things around me. And then I come up with an experiment and I prototype a different way of perceiving things around me or approaching things. So it's really playing with your perception, your feedback, your reflection, and who you want to be going forward, and acknowledging that that's always changing and it's not a constant solid thing.
And how did you come up with this concept?
Well, I was doing it on myself. I was coming up with lots of experiments myself. And I was looking at the cycles in nature. And we see, you know, the cycle of the moon. We see the cycle of the seasons. We see the cycle of insects, you know, from a mayflower into a butterfly. We see the cycle of the menstrual cycle. We see cycles of the field in industry being plowed, resting, and then growing. And so I started to wonder, what is this self-discovery cycle? I began to wonder, in the same way that we have continuous discovery as engineers in product teams, what would continuous self-discovery look like? And that's when I started to develop what would build, measure, and learn look like on an individual basis? And how can I adapt this model to serve humans in a really reliable way that is empowering and uplifting and ever-changing?
Wow. So in a way, kind of treating yourself as a product that needs constant iteration.
Yes. Exactly.
That's a very powerful way to look at yourself.
And I also think that it's a forgiving way. It's filled with compassion, because we are never done. We're always learning. And it gives us permission to just be. And that's something that I really care about, is just the permission to be wherever you're at, just accepting where you're at and not resisting it. And that's another thing that I think designers struggle with. I don't know if you have noticed this, but designers often are perfectionists. They want to do amazing work. They really want to do social good. They really want to help others. And that's what draws them in to design. But they're also really harsh on themselves. They're also really critical. They often suffer from imposter syndrome. And I think that permission to just be wherever you're at and know that you're going to be going through more and more loops in the future is quite a relief.
What stops us from just being?
It's a deep question. And I'm sure
that's
it's
what
different.
I'm here for.
it's probably different for every human. I think that the key that I found for myself, I can only speak for myself, is not being comfortable and knowing who I am. So if I don't know who I am, and if I'm feeling lost and overwhelmed and unsure, then I'm going to try and copy everything around me. I'm going to try and be, you know, a design guru that I've seen on YouTube, or I'm going to try and be Steve Jobs, or I'm going to try and be someone in Silicon Valley and copy them, or I'm going to copy my parents. And we learn by copying. That's not a bad thing. It shouldn't be our whole definition. We can learn little pieces from them. And I think that when we don't know who we are or who we want to be, it makes us very restless. And the image that I like to use is like a little jar. Like, imagine a little jam jar filled with water and soil. And when you shake that jam jar, it gets really muddy, right? It gets really cloudy and you can't see anything through it. But when you sit that jam jar on the surface and the table and you let it settle, all the dust goes down to the bottom and you can see through it really clearly. And that's when we have that clarity and we go, oh, yes, I know who I am. I know what I stand for. I know what matters to me the most. and I give myself permission to be.
Yeah, I remember like when I was a child, I really wanted to be an engineer, an electronics engineer, because my uncle was one and I thought he was very cool. But I hated maths and I didn't know that you needed to be good at maths to, you know, be a good engineer. And it was only later in life that I realized, you know what, I'm more of a people person. And luckily, I actually found something that actually enabled me to do what I enjoy doing, which was interacting with people. And that's what led me to design. I think that lack of self-awareness, right, can prevent, you know, us designers from going down the path that gives you that joy and meaning. One thing that I also notice in a lot of your writing is how you talk about the value of bringing your heart and your gut and combining that with the head. What does that mean?
I think that, you know, generally in Western society, we've kind of severed the head. We think of ourselves as these floating heads. Whereas, you know, Eastern cultures have a more holistic approach. They acknowledge the body. And you think about Ayurvedic medicine, there's a lot more integration going on. Whereas, you know, the kind of white supremacist culture says, you know, you are your intellect. And that's the most important thing, your book smart and your accolades. And so I think sometimes that seeps in to the design world, to the tech world, to the entrepreneur world, where we think, oh, well, I need to make sure everything's logical. And we also see that, you know, in the science world, which is everything must be predictable and proven. Otherwise, it's not true. And I think that negates a lot of historical wisdom, indigenous wisdom, and things that are very difficult to explain and mystical and marvelous. And so, you know, I see the next 10 years as a real rebalancing of that as we start to acknowledge different types of wisdom, different types of intellect. That leaves us into a place where we can explore things from a multitude of approaches. And we can kind of, again, accept and be and say, well, when I have that voice inside me that says this is wrong, it's okay. I can listen to that. Now, most of us don't. We ignore it, completely ignore it. And we say, la, 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 nothing's happening. And that's when we start to suffer and have pain. So, for instance, in my career, I remember the first few weeks into a job that I was doing, and I had that little voice. I was like, this is not for you. These people are not on the same wavelength at all. And instead of listening to that, I said, oh, don't worry, I'm going to change them. It's fine. I'm going to change everyone. It's going to be great. Don't let that bother you. And then, you know, year two, this is really like your health is suffering. You should probably find another job. And I'm like, no, it's not them, it's me. It's always my fault. Everything is my fault. I'm terrible. And then the third year, even when I was really suffering and had a terrible performance review, and, you know, my manager was like, are you okay? Because you look really. And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. Just completely in denial, not listening to my inner voice. And I paid the price for it. And I think all of us do that in different ways in different parts of our life. And so there needs to be this connection to what is my inner voice saying? What is my gut saying? What is my heart saying? And this connection, and even science has proved that actually the gut is a third brain and the heart has got a micro nervous system inside it. It has its own nervous system. Science has proved that, and that's mind-blowing. And actually, it's not that everything is coming from the brain down in a hierarchy to the heart and the gut, but actually there's a very complex set of instructions going both ways. And I think that's a really good reminder to us that we should trust our instinct as well as data.
I mean, it sounds like we could just have another episode just talking about this topic. I mean, there's so much for us to learn about this in terms of how we function as a human being, pretty much, right? It's not just about the brain. And I think, yeah, that's basically the programming that I was fed in terms of, like, you know, you are your brain. And whatever you do, it's all about what happens in here, in between your ears. But there's so much more to that. Thank you so much for sharing that. What has been your most favorite resource that has helped you in your career, either as a designer or as a coach or maybe just as a human being?
Two things spring to mind. One is a generic answer. You're not going to like it. But I have a lot of coaches. So I actively seek out to learn from other people because I see it as a shortcut. And I'm very hungry for growth. And I'm very hungry for development. And so to me, spending money on seeking those people out and learning and absorbing is really exciting. Just as much as, you know, a pastime like collecting model cars or to someone else, it might be fancy watches. To me, I would like to invest in meeting of minds of amazing people. So that's something that I've done for a long time. And that's definitely helped me, no doubt. But there's no one specific name because there's quite a few of them. But then in terms of a specific resource, my husband is Abdullah and he's from Iran. And his family are all very much celebrants of Rumi, who is a poet and a philosopher. And so when I got married a few years ago, I was introduced to Rumi and his writings and his poetry. And this was the first time that I could just read writing for hours and hours, a translated version. I don't speak Farsi. And I would just weep. I would just weep with the beauty of the writing. And I really felt like this human understood other humans. And I really loved the beauty in which he saw the world. So if you have a translated copy, go check out Rumi.
Great. Thanks for that, Kate. And let's imagine that it's your last day on earth and someone gave you a tiny piece of paper and said, write down your number one advice for designers and creatives all around the world. Just one thing that you could say and write down on that piece of paper. What would you write down?
Trust your gut.
Trust your gut.
Trust yourself. Yeah. Trust yourself. Yeah.
That is very powerful.
Is that
good? Love it. It's short and it's powerful. So Kate, is there anything that you'd like me to ask you that I haven't yet?
I have to think about one. I think that something that we didn't cover was just kind of talking about, from speaking to hundreds of designers, what are the kind of key themes that I've noticed? So kind of mentioning, you know, as a holistic study, a bit of user research on the species called product designers. So one thing is that in my research as a coach, I've spoken to hundreds of product designers now, and I've started to collate some affinity mapping and some themes. So the key overarching theme, which was really strong, which I was quite shocked about, was that all of the designers I spoke to have this strong need for creative freedom, trust, and growth. Those are three common factors that came up again and again. And the reason this shocked me was because I had this idea that a lot of people just go into design because it pays well and they just want a job, right? Not everybody's, you know, dying on a stone, blood drawing, you know, desperate in their career to grow. But everyone that I spoke to really wanted creative freedom, trust, and growth. And I was thinking, well, why didn't they go into art or something? You know, why, if they want creative freedom? Because design has so many limitations and it has so many technical and stakeholder and so many factors. But I think that the key takeaway that I got from that is, even if they are in some small box, even if they're only able to deal with some small part of the interface, or even if they're only able to deal within some small part of a team, they still want that permission to go crazy in that space. So it wasn't actually the size of their creative freedom. It was just, do I have some sort of creative freedom?
And some so space really for it.
Some space, yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. to express themselves and to be creative, where they can, they don't have to be accountable to someone. They can just do what they want, have autonomy. And then the other thing is that the three things that product designers have been telling me that they crave the most as an outcome is influence, impact, and income. So those are the three things that they want to optimize for. impact, as in, you know, real world impact. Am I actually helping real people? Am I helping my team? And then influence is how much am I driving the agenda? How much am I able to control what actually gets on the roadmap? How much am I able to imprint myself? And then income, how can I ensure that as I'm growing, I can actually increase my income rather than it just staying the same? So yeah, those were the three things.
Influence, income, and impact. The three I's.
Yeah.
Which is all about I, like me, like what can I influence? What can I impact? And also the income I can get for it. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, yeah. So what financial reward, what kind of financial peace of mind and stability can I get from it? Yeah, and this was across freelancers and permanent people.
Love it, love it. Thank you so much for adding that, Kate.
Thank you.
We've gone really deep in the past half an hour of our chat here. We started off with talking about just the awareness of the self and just accepting it yourself, accepting yourself as who you are. And running experiments. I think that the value of experiments seems to be so much more relevant beyond just the software and the product world into the human world, pretty much, right? We're pretty much our products that can be shaped, that can be reiterated and improved on. And treating ourselves as part of that experiment seems to be a very powerful way to look at it rather than thinking, oh, I can't do something about it, or I'm just the way it is, right? Just going for it, running the experiment, the lean loop you mentioned, like learn, build, and measure. We do that so often in the product world. Why not just do that in our own world, like personally and professionally as well? And the value of maybe getting help from people if you need it, like, for example, from coaches or from mentors who've been there and done that. And obviously the one you mentioned around taking some time out every day to just set your intention. Something that I haven't done myself much throughout my career. I just drink my coffee, just run out the door into that meeting or into that workshop or that research session without really understanding what do I intend to get out of this or what do I intend to get out of today. And it seems like just taking the time out will help you set in the right direction. So thank you so much for sharing all those insights and your stories today, Kate. So lastly, how can people find you online?
Well, thank you, Naresh, and thank you for this wonderful platform. Just kudos to you for coming up with it. And if people want to hear more about me, they can go to realityprototyping.com and they can click on the free training, watch free training. And this tells them a little bit more about the program, about me. And at the end of the training, if they feel like it's a good cup of tea, a good fit, then they can book a call with me.
Awesome. And Kate has also kindly offered a 10% discount for you on Reality Prototyping, which is a 90-day program for designers to level up their careers. You can go to designfeeling.co/Kate, where you can book a chat with her and enter the code DESIGNFEELING. That's one word, DESIGNFEELING, to get your 10% discount.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Kate. Hope you've enjoyed that.
That was so much fun. So much fun.
Thank you so much for joining me in this conversation with Kate. It really means a lot to me because I'm taking my baby steps in this podcasting journey, and you're actually helping me take those steps. So please do consider hitting the follow button so that you can get my new episodes downloaded automatically onto your device. And please share this podcast with a design thinking friend who needs a bit of design feeling in their lives. See you next time.